This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Flurries of fun await this winter in Indiana. Feel the rush of the Midwest's only refrigerated toboggan run. Ski down snow-covered slopes and marvel at frozen waterfalls on a winter hike. When it's time to unwind, from outdoor fun to indoor escapes, your perfect winter getaway starts in Indiana. Plan your trip today at inindiana.com/winter.
Good morning, folks. We've got a great show lined up for you today. At 12:30, we're going to visit with Steve Yates, Senior Research Fellow, Heritage Foundation, and former Deputy National Security Advisor to Vice President Dick Cheney. And we'll talk about European leaders gathering for emergency meeting after President Trump announces that they will not participate with the talks with President Vladimir Putin from Russia relative to trying to find resolution to the war in Ukraine. And obviously, this has upset those leaders, and we'll talk about what that means and what the downstream implications are of saying. At 12 o'clock, Eric Hessler joins us, attorney for the Policemen's Association in New Orleans. We'll get a gauge as to what the rank and file are thinking about the most recent ruling by the court to allow the promotional process to move forward. Otherwise, stating that there were no problems with it, there was not bias, there was not cheating, allegations made by the mayor of some of the folks on the review board, which were the highest ranking members in the NOPD. Really strange. We'll talk about that. Jerry Bologna, president and CEO of Jedco, joins us about a lot of great economic development news that's happening in Jefferson Parish recently. They had four or five announcements, and we'll talk about that. And at 11, we have our NOLA Coalition segment with Reverend Julius Lee, president and CEO of SMCL Foundation and Associates. So we'll talk about the mission and vision of that organization and how they are difference makers in our community. At 10:30, Craig Murdoch joins us, criminal defense attorney in New Orleans. Recent article about Louisiana standing out as a hotbed for reverse convictions. And yet, for decisions being made by prosecutors that might be unethical and that there is not a lot of accountability happening there. We'll get his thoughts and we'll talk about that. This argument about DOGE continues, the Department of Government Efficiency. It's revealing all kinds of remarkable things. We don't know to what extent all of it actually means, but what we do know, like, for example, recent revelations about the Social Security system, that they are tracking alleged payments that are being made to individuals that are 150 plus years old. Interesting. Now, what they also say is that these individuals, or whoever's receiving these checks, have not negotiated these Social Security checks. So I guess they feel like there's no risk, but I would say to the contrary, why are they still being sent? Why are we still quantifying that amount of dollars that's out there? And why are we keeping data about these people at all? They passed away. They're gone. They're not entitled to receive any other monies, and nor are any of their family members. it seems as though they have difficulty managing the information that they absolutely have to manage, that is critical to manage, but yet they're managing a sphere of information that's so far greater it doesn't make any sense. And we're seeing this repeat itself over and over and over again in many different ways. And it's not a bad idea, in my view, to go look at programs to see if what we're doing, although it may be well-intentioned and altruistic in nature, is it actually accomplishing anything? And is there an opportunity for a collection of countries to come together and influence issues that are creating these crises around the world in a different way? One of the findings that is out there as a result of this 90-day pause as it relates to the funding of a number of foreign programs, we're learning about the impact that it will have on NGOs, religious organizations, or others that are providing these services. One such is reported by the National Catholic Reporter publication was the Jesuit Refugee Service that has been in the refugee assistance sphere for a long, long time. They are looked upon by many as being one of the lead agencies in dealing with refugees. In fact, as a result of this freeze, according to Kelly Ryan, president of JRS USA and regional director of JRS North America, they are so reliant on federal funding that already 400 of the Jesuit Refugee Services, accounting for 11,000 staff members, have been laid off. These are huge bureaucracies, administrative costs, consuming gobs and gobs of money, and one has to wonder actually how much is actually ending up to those that are actually in need. It's really worth looking at this. This is not a knock on JRS. This is what you do in the private sector. This is what you do in order to achieve efficiency and effectiveness. And in fact, previous leaders of that organization have publicly stated that they don't see a problem with looking at this. In fact, Carolyn Wu, who served as president and CEO of Catholic Relief Services from 2012 to 2016, told National Catholic Reporter that she supports reforms to make government services more efficient, but cautioned that any changes have to be made with consideration for the impacts on vulnerable populations. Now, that begs the question, what is it that we're actually accomplishing? We may be well-intentioned in what we're trying to do, but what is actually happening operationally out there? One of the biggest programs that they have are the refugee camps in Chad because of the civil war that's gone on in Sudan, in Africa. And right on the Chad-Sudan border, you will find 1.3 million displaced people that are there. They're struggling. Malnutrition, lack of water, insecurity, forcible recruitment by armed groups to do all kinds of horrific things, to basically become slaves. These refugee camps in Chad are so overcrowded, conditions there have not improved measurably since the whole thing started. And there are dozens and dozens and dozens of organizations that are there trying to assist. And many who have visited there have said they appreciate the effort, but this is not getting measurably better, and they don't see an end to this. In fact, to the contrary, what they're finding is that there are more and more numbers of folks moving across the border into Chad as a result of the civil war in Sudan. So one has to ask, right? Is there a better way to deal with this issue and this civil war in Sudan that is creating this humanitarian crisis, to wit, we, you, me, everyone else, our tax dollars are being sent over there to fund and finance a lot of what's happening? And it may be to no avail. It may be that it's a far gone conclusion. Because unless we can eliminate a lot of the challenges that they have, and it doesn't seem like money is going to be the one that's going to be able to do it, we're just delaying an outcome that is readily apparent. And that course has already been predetermined. So it seemed to me at some point it would beg a different approach. How do we get there? Is there the appetite for this country to continue to fund and finance foregone conclusions, foregone outcomes? It doesn't make much sense. You see, the benefit of DOGE is going to come in many shapes and forms. And it will compel us to look at political issues critically and compel a decision-making process as to how we are going to change the course of things that are happening out there if we so choose. The toe-in-the-water approach cannot work. We're either all in or we're not in. It's plain and simple. Our allies are either all in or not in. We can't continue to finance these bureaucratic and, these NGOs overwhelmed with administrative costs and expenses and everything else that goes along with that. It's not easy to provide these services over there. I get it. It's not a criticism. It's just an observation. And for how many years are we willing to do so? I often remind folks when we have these conversations that we have over 40 million people living below the federally identified poverty level in our own country. We're struggling to figure out how to finance Medicaid for those that are struggling financially. I dare say that almost every family in this country probably has a Medicaid recipient. It's something very important to us. We can't adequately fund and finance that, and yet we're involved in other programs that we're not going to be able to achieve any meaningful outcomes. And I guess the question is, how many billions of dollars are we willing to put forth to this effort? Is this just about bolstering the reputation of the U.S. government? Is the general public willing to accept funding and financing a number of these activities on a particular whim of the leader of the day or a whim of Congress? Are we providing oversight to make sure the dollars are being spent where they're supposed to be spent? And what we are finding out right now is that, in fact, that's not the case. And it's amazing how we are now engaged in this deflection, denial, evasion, and counterattacks. And that's what the Democratic Party is involved in. In fact, I am so tired of hearing Musk was not elected. What does that mean? The internal auditors, they weren't elected. All the other folks that are providing oversight in the bureaucratic state, separate and apart from the congressional committees, they weren't elected. Efficiency consultants that you hire all the time in some of the largest consulting firms in the world that are hired by the U.S. government day in and day out, where the U.S. government is their largest client, who are providing some of the same information that is being provided by DOGE, they're not elected. So what is it that we fear? That's the real question. What is it that we fear that we're opposed to looking at the bureaucratic state and some of the findings which are compelling us to look at ourselves critically in the mirror? There are those conspiracy theorists out there that believe there's something that they're hiding, that there's going to be a connection to particular individuals or organizations that curry favor for one party or the other. I really kind of believe it's just more elementary than that, right? We fear change. We want to be all things to all people. We want to be the chameleon. We can't, because what we're finding is that we might be in a lot of different buckets, but we're not doing the most incredible work in each one of those, the most efficient. We're not reaching the outcomes of the mission and vision of these strategies that we're deploying, and we fear having them judged because we've created a bureaucratic state that relies on these very programs for their sustenance in perpetuity. And in many cases, that's all they know. But how do we continue to finance this? $36 trillion in debt in the 2030s. They believe that that number is going to be about $52 trillion in debt. We cannot just keep racking up the debt and think it's not going to create huge hurdles and problems for us to ever balance a budget, adopt a budget for that matter, without having these years on end continuing resolutions. Because we can't come to some agreement as to that. And yes, we kind of discard anything that anyone has to say, like in the refugee world. Oh, it's only $40 billion. It only makes up 1% of our budget. Yeah, but there's 1,000 other programs just like this. And if there are only $40 billion, they're consuming more and more and more of the overall budget of this country. Now, obviously, that math doesn't match up. I just throw that out to be illustrative. But we as taxpayers, I believe that we should compel answers. It doesn't mean elimination of programs, but it should compel answers about how we're spending our money, where we're spending our money, who is spending our money? Who are the primary recipients of this money that are in turn delivering the services? Are the services being delivered? Are we getting what we're paying for? Isn't that important? It's important as you sit down in every household and figure out how much money you have and where you're going to spend it, right? It's important in every mom and pop business, small business, medium-sized business, large businesses. Are you getting what you pay for? As a consumer, we make these evaluations all day. It's amazing to me that we're getting caught up in the rhetoric about who is looking and who is the front man, Elon Musk, not elected, as opposed to the outcome. I don't know about you. I don't really have a feeling one way or the other about Elon Musk. He's a very wealthy individual, very successful individual. He's had probably as many failures as he's had successes. You'll never succeed if you don't get in the game. So that's an expectation that's out there. We're here. We're having people focus now on failures. Well, if you don't step into the arena, you know, and you never had a failure, you're not likely to ever have a success. Again, deflection, denial, evasion, and then counterattack. They have it down to a science. It's an art form for those that have fear of change. And it would seem to me, why don't we just look at the outcomes? let's determine whether or not they're real. They're providing a number of stuff, right? They say that these are the receipts. I don't know if they are or they aren't. Well, let's go look at them. And let's go figure it out. You know, there's a bunch of little anecdotal things that crop up that are kind of crazy. And we feel like, why would we be funding that? Why would that be something that we would be interested in? You see that time and time again. And it would seem to me that that would beg that certain questions be asked. The same thing came up in the refugee world about programs being funded. Wondering why we would do so. I think people are a little curious about these things, about programs, you know, that are being eliminated at certain times. But let's just let it take its course. And it's interesting, we're fighting over who's got access to data. Well, the bureaucrats have access to the data. If you become president and you hire another individual in the executive department of government, how is it that they're shielded from seeing the data, but every other bureaucrat can see the data? Doesn't make any sense. Is there a special class of bureaucrats that are out there? Is there a number of years to qualify before you can see certain data as opposed to other data? There are protections for this data. If that individual violates the data, then he needs to be charged and go to jail or whatever the sanctions are for doing so. But he's no different than any other bureaucrat. So it'll be interesting to see where this ultimately ends up. And we should judge each and every one of these programs as to whether or not we are achieving meaningful outcomes. And we shouldn't just be in it for the sake of being in it. We'll be right back.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed's sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not so secret secret with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Aloe, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed's sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+.
Before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recaps. And after that, we're going to keep going as we recap every episode of season 2.
The Severance podcast with Ben Stiller and Adam Scott is presented by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Listen and follow now on Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
But dude averages 18 yards after catch.
We get it. When you're passionate about something, you go all in. You live entirely in that world. That's exactly how Graybar is about renewable energy projects.
He's all fourth quarter, such a
join our league of clean energy at Graybar.com. Yep, Graybar does that.
Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Craig Murdoch, criminal defense attorney in New Orleans. There was an article outlining a series of cases that are emblematic, according to the author, that Louisiana is a hotbed for overturned convictions, and asks why prosecutors rarely face discipline. Craig's here to add some context to this. Craig, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Noel. How you doing this morning?
Doing well, doing well. So, and in your world, What have you seen, and what causes you concerned about, I guess the only way you can characterize this is prosecutorial misconduct, right?
Correct. And I guess what concerns me is there is a lack of controls in the system in terms of when evidence can be turned over, what can be turned over. As the article points out, the Brady decision and some of its subsequent cases outline what prosecutors need to do in order to turn over exculpatory evidence and evidence like that. But ultimately, at least prior to trial, there's no teeth in the Brady decision. There's nothing to penalize the state for holding this back to the last minute. A lot of times judges will allow this evidence to come in the night before a trial or a couple days before trial starts. And all of a sudden, as a defense attorney, you're investigating things or trying to follow up on things that you didn't even know about. Ultimately, that's going to lead to problematic convictions that and that's when they turn the evidence over. Obviously, we have a host of convictions here where evidence hasn't even, you know, exculpatory evidence wasn't even turned over. And at that point, you're costing people years of freedom while these cases wind through the system. And as you know, and I'm sure your audience is familiar with, once you're convicted, getting that overturned, even in a state like Louisiana, known for overturned convictions, becomes somewhat difficult to do and is a lengthy court process. So that would be my number one concern. I mean, I see this. I mean, I wouldn't say I see it in every case, but there are a lot of times where I'm getting ready for trial and it's the next day and all of a sudden I'm getting some notes from an investigator that changed the context of what the complainant had said, that type of thing.
So, Craig, I've always been curious about this because I've always been a firm believer if you want a fair and just system, you have to pay for it. You can't do it on the cheap, right? I was one of early onset few sheriffs that stood up in defense of the Indigent Defender Board. If we have an adversarial system, we need to make sure that both sides are adequately funded. Otherwise, it will never be a fair and just system. And I wonder how much of this is really a byproduct of us doing this on the cheap. Because it seems to me, and I want to ask the question this way, who's in the best position to police this process as we're going through the exchange of information relative to Brady material and for the benefit of the listening audience? That's evidence that is favorable to the defendant, that is in the hands of the prosecutor. And it seems to me that person is the judge, right? Or am I wrong?
I completely agree. The trial judge has a gatekeeping function. But if he doesn't know about this and the prosecutor doesn't say, I have this, or says it's, you know, it happens too late in the process, his hands are essentially tied. But I do agree that there probably should be something codified in law that says, you know, prior to a criminal trial, this is the evidentiary cutoff date. We don't have that now. In a civil trial, Newell, you know your evidence probably 60 days before your trial date. In a criminal trial, I mean, I'm getting evidence sometimes the night before I'm ready to go to trial. And I do think codifying that in a clear cutoff date that says any evidence turned over 14 days or 21 days before trial cannot be used. And that would be a clear line of demarcation for everybody to know, okay, this can't come in. The law says this can't come in. Right now, it's basically judge's discretion whether they let it in or not. And, most judges here are elected. Their answer, well, all the criminal court judges are elected, and they're answerable to the people. And if you have a series of not allowing evidence in or not, you know, continuing trials at the last second, the people are going to want to know why this keeps occurring, and they're going to bounce it back to the judge and not necessarily the prosecutor's office.
You know, it's
interesting. I do agree with you that funding the public defender's office fully and on a level with the DA's office would go a long way.
I absolutely think that that's fundamentally fair and needs to happen, and have access to experts like everyone else. Because we get these sometimes crazy outcomes and the reputation of the system is impaired, and it's hard to get it back, right? You got to work three times as hard. But you know what's interesting?
I
thought we were moving to open discovery. Are we not there?
It is. So to answer your question, there's open discovery, and in which you can go, and in particular, certain parishes are very good about this. You make an appointment, the prosecutor just hands you the file in the conference room, you copy everything, you write everything down, and you take it with you, and you have everything in the file that the prosecutor has. However, as you know, investigations are ongoing up until probably the trial date.
Yeah.
So there are times where they're dynamic. Things come later. Things change, or memories change, but those things need to be turned over. I mean, they're still being held on to too late in the game. And then if you consider, I mean, if you look at the one case in New Orleans, that John Thompson case, I mean, they didn't put the exculpatory evidence even in the file. It was, so even if you had open file discovery, that wasn't even there. So that was, that's kind of the case that's sort of, as you would say, emblematic of systemic failures, is the John Thompson case.
But if procedurally there was something that was adopted, you know, you don't see a lot of this happening in federal court, right?
There's never,
as you well know, pretrial procedure. The judge, there's no doubt who's in charge in federal court. I've been there as the defendant representative of the sheriff's office, been in these pretrial conferences. There is no doubt who's in charge. And they read you the Riot Act if you have something that you didn't turn over within the time constraints in advance of trial. And in a lot of cases, there's no doubt that you're not going to be able to use that piece of evidence. So you're just cutting off your nose to spite your face if, you know, you're pushing the outer edges of a ruling, or knowing, you know, how that particular court pre-tries these cases. I know when I was down in criminal district court back in the late 70s, there were probably three judges that actually pre-tried cases out of the entire bench. I don't know how many do it today. And he did it effectively. And they put the fear of God in you if you had something and you didn't turn it over. You know, you were going to be disciplined.
Pre-trials. We do get a lot of pre-trials, but the pre-trial exists where the prosecutor explains the case. And then that's sort of the end of it. It's not where the judge says, all right, you know, we're going to do it on this. The judge is not necessarily laying down the law in a way that they do in federal court. It is a much more prosecutor-driven process.
So why not change it? Why not change it? What do we fear? Somebody's got to fear something, right?
That is an excellent question. And I think codified criminal discovery rules, codified criminal discovery cutoff dates would go a long way to helping everybody in the system because there would be no discretion. There would be nothing to say you can't present this or you can present it. And that would obviously everybody would know what their obligations are. Right now, it's sort of like, oh, I can turn this over the night before and I know I'm going to get cover for it. That's sort of where the prosecutors are thinking largely. And again, as you know, sometimes investigations, things happen as you're trying to get ready for trial. So, that does occasionally happen, but a clear date, it would also push the ability of the prosecutor to get ready for trial, you know, 2-3 weeks out, so everybody had a clear idea of where things stood, as opposed to, you know, running around last second, maybe missing things, that type of thing. So, yeah, I do think codifying it would be, it would go a long way, and it would take pressure off everybody in the system, because you know what your obligations are under the law. And
yeah,
it wouldn't be
I
that
hope...
difficult, no, because in civil in civil cases, that's what you have. It's very clear in civil cases what your obligations are in discovery and when it needs to be turned over. And it's completely not codified and doesn't make a lot of sense in criminal court.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but I'm tired of hearing and arguing about discriminatory intent, about, you know, disproportionate impact, disproportionate outcome. I'm tired of all of that. And I think we need to get to a place where we're not compelled to talk about that any longer. And it's you said the word, and it leads to all of that, and that's discretion. The exercise of discretion by certain people in certain ways always leads to ultimate problems down the road. And when you eliminate discretion, I've been an advocate of an if X, then Y system for a long time, because it eliminates all these arguments that we're having on the sidelines, around the edges of the game, as opposed to focusing on the game, a fair and just system and trial, plain and simple, right? And it just seems as though we should be able to get there. We're smarter than this, I can promise you. And I think there should be a solution. Craig Murdoch, as always, thank you so much for joining us. Yes, go ahead, Craig. Hurry up.
I have one last point I want to make. In that article that you referenced, former Justice Creighton talked about using the disciplinary process as a learning process for ADAs, which is fine, but there's no consequence to it. And a learning process without consequences, you know, you just said it, if X, then Y, is useless and not really a learning process. So I would just leave it at that in terms of where the article is and how maybe we should approach this from a disciplinary perspective.
Absolutely. There has to be a consequence, accountability. It's how we raise our children, right? It's not much different.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, it seems to me to be low-hanging fruit for the most part. Well, thank you so much for joining.
It was great talking to you. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, Craig, thank you. I appreciate your time, your insight. Have a great week. We'll be right back, folks. Folks, when we come back after the top of the hour news break, we'll do our NOLA Coalition segment with Reverend Julius Lee, President and CEO of SMCL Foundation, and he's also president of Paralyzed Veterans of America, the Bayou Gulf States chapter in Southeast Louisiana Veterans Healthcare System. We'll talk about programs that they're doing to help paralyzed veterans and others for our NOLA Coalition segment, and then we'll visit with Jerry Bologna, President and CEO of JEDCO, with some recent announcements that they have in Jefferson Parish, the bicentennial year for the parish. So stay with us. We will be right back after the break.
Every week on the Moth Podcast, we share stories that are funny, strange, heartbreaking, and above all, true.
I myself have been married for 56 years. Unfortunately, to four different women.
It turns out the people I was looking for all my life is what you people would call nerds.
Follow and listen to The Moth on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.